will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken through the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. But he had no union with her until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. So reads the word of the Lord. Our song of preparation is Psalm 132, verses 1, 6, and 10, speaking both of the people's struggle and the steadfast love of the Lord to preserve the throne of David by setting a son on his throne forever. Psalm 132, verses 1, 6, and 10. Let us again open the scriptures to the reading for the sermon text, which is Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah chapter 7, we'll read the whole chapter, verses 1 to 25. The text sets us square in the middle of a threatening situation for Judah. There is the promise from God of a great sign for their deliverance. Let us begin reading Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out, you and your son Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Say to him, 'Be careful, keep calm, and do not be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, "Let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it." Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says: it will not take place, it will not happen, for the head of Aram is Damascus and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all." Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test." Then Isaiah said, Hear you, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. And the Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. In that day, the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the crevices and in the rocks, on the thorn bushes and at all the water holes. In that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs and to take off your beards also. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats, and because of the abundance of the milk they will give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day, in every place where there are 1,000 vines, in that day, in every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels, silver shekels, there will be only briars and thorns. Men will go there with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. And for all the hills, once cultivated by the hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and thorns. They will become places where cattle are turned loose and where sheep run." May the Lord bless his word this morning. Brothers and sisters, political upheaval is nothing new in our world. Canada is definitely no stranger to it. I think one of the big issues, really, is how a nation can, for whatever reasons, forget, reject, and revise their history, how it can obscure and even lose its past. Whether a nation's history was bad, good, or somewhere in between, it ought to be remembered. New generations need to be taught what to do and what not to do. We need to learn from history. We need to sufficiently know the past if we are to have any prospect of doing better in the future. But sadly, our world seems to be more given to forgetting, rejecting, and revising history. And so we are given over and over again, on repeat, to upheaval and crisis. But just say we wanted to remember, where would we begin? Where should we begin? Well, why don't we take it all the way back to the beginning, like Ecclesiastes 12, which is a great place to start with, remembering your Creator. However, we do not see the knowledge of God as worth retaining. And for this, our world continues to writhe in chaos. There is a conservative commentator I kind of listen to somewhat regularly. There's a number of them, but he has some good perspectives on culture and society and politics. However, even though he was raised a Christian, he openly says he sees no need whatsoever to ground truth or anything in God. He sees there's no need for that. Unfortunately, he has chosen not to remember his Creator, and he has settled for a revised history in evolutionary terms. And so his very bottom-line beliefs on how the universe came about are going to undermine his values and desires going forward. Whatever else we have chosen to reject, forget, and revise, what else could there be? Well, we can go just take one step further in the storyline. Adam and Eve, the progenitors of the human race. And what's the significance of that? Well, all our woes are traced back to their eating of the forbidden fruit, running after Satan's deception that we can be like God. We can stand in his place. And that certainly hasn't worked, and it never will work. Still, since the fall, we try our hardest to make it work, to forget and revise our history of exile from Eden, from alienation from God. Even though God's blessing of day seven is largely diminished on creation and in its place is the curse of which he did warn, we keep barreling down this broad, wayward path. And we are all at risk of it. None of us are immune to this. Even as we sit here in the pews professing the name of Jesus, we are susceptible. We're not careful. Our children are at risk of this deception, of rejecting the true faith of the church. That is why many chase the forbidden fruit when they get the chance. Heading into college, into university, wherever. Though some sooner or later learn their lesson from the evil and crisis that it causes them spiritually and also externally in their life. And these prodigals return home to the gospel they had left behind. And that's good, but how many of us have those desert wandering stories? Maybe never left the church and sat in the pew from Sunday to Sunday, but were far from the Lord in your heart. Maybe not really believing and struggling with that. Again, sadly, there are those who never return, even though the end is ruin. We do have an issue. And unfortunately, when we come to Isaiah, this is the state of Israel. In spite of all the Lord's gracious warnings, they have long since drifted from him, from his steadfast love, from all that he had done for them, and from the eternal purpose to which he had called them. And so when we get to Isaiah chapter 7, we find that Judah in particular is facing great political turmoil because of this forgetfulness. Well, Judah's experience will speak to us. Some context might be helpful in making sense of their self-induced situation and also of our own proclivity to the same error. Isaiah is a prophet who lived and fulfilled his ministry from 740 to 686 B.C., ministering through the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah in Judah. But the more specific time frame is the early reign of Ahaz when we come to chapter 7 here. There is an Israel-Syria alliance. Remember, the northern tribes had broken off. They're doing their own thing. They've forgotten their God as well. And they've allied with this other Gentile nation, Syria. And they're coming against Ahaz, along with us also the pending Assyrian judgment that the Lord is bringing on Israel and to a serious extent on Judah. So it is a tumultuous time, to say the least. However, the calamity is due, as we've said here already, to Israel and Judah's increasingly blatant violation of God's covenant with them through Moses. Instead of all the wonderful blessings that he had promised, the terrifying curses that he warned of are now being poured out. And that sounds rather bleak, yet embedded in the pending disaster of Isaiah 7, there is this gracious call to Ahaz. A gracious call from God to faith. And it's also accompanied by a tremendous sign of confirmation. And so let us walk through this together here. Isaiah chapter 7 showcases for our learning Ahaz's situation and choice. Assyria is the rising superpower who is proceeding to dominate the world of the day, which domination is only permitted by the Lord for his sovereign purposes, of course, as we see in Isaiah. But it is in this time Isaiah, and we in thinking of here chapters 1 to 7, had prophesied judgment for rebellious Israel and Judah. Even if you were to look back in chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, you'll see a song of lament by the Lord for his vineyard, in which he begins by recalling his early love for them and calling them to himself, and then his later grief over their bad fruit after all he had done for them, the bad fruit that they had bore. So we see this is a very serious time. Yet God's calling and election are irrevocable. So after they have been severely chastised for their sins, God also, through Isaiah, promises them a glorious restoration. So some of the bigger picture there. However, we have to realize that Judah, at this point in time, is only at the judgment stage of the prophecy that's given here in chapter 7. This is Ahaz's situation, and he happens to be one of the many unbelieving, unfaithful kings leading Judah further into spiritual decay and looming national disaster. As I said, a Syrian-Israelite coalition has formed in resistance to Assyria's approaching threat. The two allied kings, Pekah of Israel and Rezin of Syria, had prior pressured King Ahaz to join their resistance. But since he refused them, they are now mounting an attack on him. It is at this time Isaiah is sent to offer Ahaz God's protection from all his foes. But Ahaz responds out of fear and unbelief. Instead of trusting God for deliverance, he plans to turn to Assyria for help. As a result, God not only incites Assyria to defeat Syria and Israel, but he also will make Judah subservient to the Syrian Empire as well. But we don't want to forget that it is unbelief that has driven this snowballing situation for Judah. Yet there is hope, and this hope demands a closer look from us. And so chapter 7 centers around a prophetic message from the Lord through Isaiah and his son, Shear-Jashub, to Ahaz, king of Judah. Yet what is more, the message given Isaiah has great implications reaching far beyond Ahaz and Judah in their present moment, has far-reaching implications beyond that and application. In verses 1 to 2, King Ahaz and thus Judah are truly in an extremely threatening situation. Because, as I said, Ahaz had refused to join Pekah and Rezin against Syria, and they're now attacking him with a plan to take Judah and Jerusalem for their own depraved ends, without a care for the Lord's promise to David and his line. But they're not able to overpower Jerusalem, because the Lord will not permit it. And so this lets us know that even though Ahaz is an unbelieving and wicked king, the Lord is implying there is something better in store for the line of David than what Ahaz has to offer. However, lacking faith, word of this alliance coming against him deeply shakes Ahaz and the people as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. They are shaking in their boots. And that just makes it clear that they do not trust in the Lord their God. They are in bondage to the fear of man and to what's going on in the world around them. I think we can relate to that. We have a tendency to go that direction as well. Verses 3 to 11. Yet Isaiah and his son, Shear-Jashub, are sent in this moment of great crisis to encourage King Ahaz. They're sent to encourage this disobedient, unfaithful, unbelieving king by calling him to faith in the Lord, You can see the grace of God at work here. Calling him to faith in God in the face of a pending threat. The Lord will not allow Pekah and Rezin to succeed, for the Lord will not give up on the house of David. Rather, the promise of a great sign is about to emerge here and to be revealed. So the expression in verse 2, the house of David, refers to the current head of the house, Ahaz. The expression also recalls the Lord's covenant with David back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, promising him an eternal heir for the kingdom, for his throne. And so that just means any attempt to replace David's dynasty with another will not succeed, for God's promises would be at stake. And he's not about to let that happen. And since everything is under the sovereign power of the Lord, he puts a choice before Ahaz. Isaiah's son, Shear Jashub, whose name means a remnant will return, is to be either understood as a threat that God's judgment would fall on the people, leaving only a remnant, or as a promise that by God's grace there would be a surviving remnant. Can be applied either way. We'll see that here in this text. His name is a summary of Isaiah's two-pronged message to Ahaz of judgment or restoration. His choice is ruin or salvation. Will he fear men? Will he seek the help of a man? Or will he fear and trust in the Lord? Just pause here and ask yourself a question. What would you do if you were in Ahaz's shoes and you saw all this political trouble converging upon you and happening within you? What would you do at that point? What would you be looking for at that point? Where would you be looking for help? Well, maybe you're not in that big of a predicament as Ahaz was. But what is your tendency in the pressing times in your life? When difficult things are converging upon you and threatening you. Young people, peer pressure. Older people, difficult work environments. What does turmoil, even as we're beginning to experience in our own country, reveal about what we really trust in? What does that bring to the surface? What does that reveal about us? Maybe it could be in contradiction to our own profession. What does it reveal about what we might truly trust in? Is it man, a different government, or is it the Lord? Do we truly believe and bank on the gospel truth that Christ is at the right hand of the Father, orchestrating all nations to the Father's end? Is that the first thing we think of? Is that what encourages us? Or is it something else, lesser than that? Is it the things of man rather than the things of God? And so the Lord cautions Ahaz on what he will do regarding Rezin and Pekah. Will he believe the Lord that these threats are nothing more than smoldering stubs soon to burn out? Will he go on seeing men as bigger than God, or will he flip that around the right way? So after a gracious call to faith, the Lord then further offers something amazing to Ahaz. Verse 11, he's to ask for a sign of assurance, not just anything. He says, however deep, however high, whatever it is, ask, and that the Lord would perform it for him. A sign of confirmation, a sign of assurance. He calls him to faith, trust in me, and I will give you a sign to confirm that for you. That's pretty amazing. But then we come to verses 12 to 13. Shockingly, Ahaz declines the Lord's invitation and offer, masking his unbelief with false piety. And so the real issue here is that Ahaz has already determined in his heart to trust in Assyria, a choice that will turn on him and Judah, as Isaiah further predicts in this chapter. Ahaz and Judah, save a remnant, are consumed with the things of man and not of God. And that becomes very clear. And does that not cut us to the heart? Or are we not easily tempted to this as well? And so it's made manifest that Ahaz is not interested in any sign because he does not want God. He sees no value to God. Romans 1:28. He doesn't seem fit to retain that. He doesn't see any use for that. He's cast that behind him. And thus his mind is already made up to appeal to Assyria for help. His claim of not wanting to trust the Lord is but to put the Lord to the test is but a pretense. And so Isaiah then sharply denounces him. If you just look in verse 13, you see how Isaiah now speaks of my God instead of your God. It becomes clear. And he promises a sign whether or not the king wants it. And the situation reveals the corrupt spiritual and condition of the house of David, what it had degraded into. It has failed. It has failed. But the good news is this, and it's strongly hinted at in this chapter, is that David's house will not fail forever. This is not final. Verses 14 to 25, therefore, even though Ahaz is faithless, the Lord, who remains ever faithful to his promises, proceeds to give the sign anyway. Verses 14 to 16, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. You will see this with your own eyes. Yes, Ahaz will certainly see what the Lord can do in removing the threat of Syria and Israel. Sadly, however, as also prophesied in verses 17 to 25, the sign will not be to Ahaz's benefit. Instead, for Ahaz, it will be the negative fulfillment of a remnant for Judah will be cut down in judgment to a few. Great suffering will come not only on Israel but also on Judah. The Assyrian king from whom Ahaz would rather seek help will cause a time of suffering that is likened to when Israel broke away from Judah under Rehoboam, Solomon's son. Because Ahaz refused to trust God, Assyria would invade Judah and cause great damage. The name Emmanuel therefore served as a rebuke to Ahaz. He refused to believe that God was with Judah and that he had no need to crawl to the Assyrians. For Numbers 14:9, the expression, "The Lord is with us," was meant to reduce Israel's fear, to remove Israel's fear of the Canaanites and the surrounding nations. But Ahaz forfeited this encouragement and comfort of faith. He gave it up. And this is a great lesson for us to prayerfully inquire about the ways in which we tend to forfeit the benefits of Christ that are ours in faith. I said we're not immune to this. So long as our eyes are upon the Lord Jesus Christ, that won't happen. But we can be distracted, turned away. And we can forfeit some of these benefits at times in some measure. And so we need to take the example here. But notwithstanding the blatant unbelief and covenant breaking, the Lord will fulfill his great promise to David. A truly good king will arise to fulfill the promise of restoration. And so we can be ever thankful that the folly of man and even our own moments of foolishness in no way cuffs God or thwarts his redemptive plan. Just look to Christ who breaks the seven seals of the scroll and brings it all to pass according to plan in Revelation 4 to 6. We can rejoice and be thankful that our God will go ahead with his plan of redemption regardless. That he will not break his promise to David. He will not break his promise to his people. So let us further then consider the grand sign promised in Isaiah 7:14. While this sign of the Lord is a form of judgment on Ahaz and Judah for their unbelief, it is still at the same time a promise that God is with his people. He will protect and save his unbelieving remnant, even as he is simultaneously chastising them. Everything that's happening is chastising his people here. It's nothing out of his control. It's nothing random that's happening that he didn't see coming. He is orchestrating all things, and he's disciplining his people through these judgments. But at the same time, in the very midst of that, he is able to protect and keep his believing remnant. Thus, the sign of 7:14, Emmanuel, God with us, has a twofold fulfillment. First is this provisional fulfillment in the moment of Ahaz's situation, which also will extend through that into the long exile that Judah will eventually be sent under Babylon. Okay, that provision will continue. He will not forsake or leave his people. He will be with them. He will be with his people through whatever they have to face and endure. This likely means the prophecy of a virgin conceiving and bearing a son whom she calls Emmanuel, being initially provisional and temporary, was maybe applied. Scholars are not sure as to who it exactly applied. I'm not going to go into that and waste your time here with that. It could have been Isaiah's wife. It could have been some young lady that was known to Ahaz and Isaiah. And it could have been confirmed. It would have been confirmed by them. So we see that there was this provisional, temporary fulfillment. But second, this initial provisional fulfillment is far from true fulfillment. Judah, tragically choosing to go down the same sinful path as the rest of Israel had, and that Emmanuel's land will be overtaken and his people exiled, would imply a termination of the Lord's promise and an end to the house of David. So there's got to be more than this. Because if that's all there is, that would run completely contrary to what we sang about, to what we have read about. It would be contrary, it would be completely contrary to the promise that God swore an oath. Clearly, there is something far more regarding the sign of 7:14. God's promise that he would always be with his people. For even though he is judging them for their sin, at the appointed time he will restore them and judge their enemies. Therefore, the situation cannot end in judgment for Judah or Israel. But what else is there to look forward to now that all looks rather like a lost cause here? What else is there to look forward to? Well, instead of despair, it is correct to conclude that whoever it was who temporarily bore the title Emmanuel was never going to be the prime fulfillment of this grand sign. God is with his people. But who then would that be? Who do we turn to now? What do we look for? Well, fast forward from the 700s BC to the dawn of the first century AD, and it is time for Isaiah's prophecy of Israel's restoration to begin. This is where we see the true Emmanuel, who is Jesus, at the set time he has entered Israel's captivity. He's entered into that. We read about that in Matthew 1:1-17. And so Matthew picks up in his gospel account where Isaiah had left the people of God, which was in going into exile, into judgment. And the point is that their time has been served. Now is the time for deliverance. Like I said, the first 17 verses of Matthew 1 reveal that Jesus Christ is the arrival of the long-awaited Son of David, who will take the throne and lead his people into everlasting victory. You might ask, what does this deliverance actually look like? Well, that's going to have to wait for next Sunday. I'll give you a bit of a cliffhanger. Suffice it to say for now, Matthew 1:18-25 declares that, number one, King Jesus will save his people from their sins. That'll be the first and most important thing. And two, he will fulfill the title Emmanuel, translated, the God is with us. He will truly be God with us now and forever. And the time for this has come. And this is our hope too. For Isaiah taught that Emmanuel is also for all the nations. All the nations can be recipients of God's blessing through Abraham. And this is great. This is great news. But at the same time, it leaves the people of God in an interesting situation. How are we any better off today believing in Emmanuel than were the people of God in Isaiah's day? We are in the same basic ongoing political and economic upheaval, nationally, internationally, that Judah and Israel were. The world really hasn't changed in 2,000 years. And so that presses us to ask, what difference has and does Jesus make? Is there really any benefit for us in the gospel? Again, we'll dive more into that next Sunday. But for now, Isaiah 7:14, fulfilled by Christ, means we are awaiting his second advent. This season, we're remembering his first one. We're looking for his second one. That is, we are awaiting a grand consummation of both global and even cosmic proportions. Isaiah speaks of this, a new heavens and a new earth. God's going to gather the nations into. It will be the restoration of that which he prophesied. It would be the restoration of which he prophesied and has most certainly begun, but it isn't yet completed. For now, numbered among the remnant, we continue to walk by faith. We know we have far more going for us since Christ has come, though. We have more going for us than they did back in Ahaz's day. Our confidence ought to be even greater because we have Jesus Emmanuel, who has fulfilled the old covenant types and shadows in the new covenant. So we should have even more confidence. And it should be obvious to us that if God has been faithful this far, the rest will follow. It will come. And as God was with his people throughout their captivity, so he's still with us as we sojourn in this world of turmoil. He will preserve and keep us and all who will yet come to trust in him until that great day of his second advent. So let us be very cautious not to get stuck in our own little situations, in our own little head spaces. Let us not forget the bigger picture and to keep looking for the return of our Emmanuel. What therefore might be our main takeaway from this first Advent sermon? Well, since we are in the same essential global situation as were Judah and King Ahaz, we must see that Isaiah's message to Ahaz and Judah is intended to make an impact on everyone who hears it in one of two ways. Either this book will harden the reader's pride against God, as it did for Ahaz, or it will become, to the contrite reader, a feast of refreshment in God, encouragement as to what he is going to yet do. Our world since Isaiah's day has continued in the crazy cycle of upheaval and crisis. So have our lives. Our Lord Jesus said that much, that there would be wars and rumors of wars, and not to be alarmed and consumed and overwhelmed by that, not to be driven into despair. So while Canada, having known a stretch of maybe relative peace and prosperity, has in some sense forgotten Emmanuel, because of this, poor decisions are being made that have begun to overturn the peace and prosperity. We all feel the deeper rumblings as laws and policies are being passed that serve the greedy, oppressed people and oppose Christianity. We may even be tempted to ask, is God no longer keeping our land glorious and free? Well, really, who but God knows how and where things will go for our country and even for our own lives? Exactly. He knows. We need to prayerfully do our best as Canadians to make our land a better place. As Christians, we must primarily focus on our greater calling. Having been presented with such a great sign and promise, now that the true Emmanuel has come, will we go down the dreadful path of Ahaz? Will we run to earthly powers, peoples, and things to save us? No. We're being called to so much more, away from that which seeks to hook us and draw us away, and instead turn fully to what God has promised, to affirm trust in Jesus, our Emmanuel. So let us look at this Advent season as a special time to renew our faith in Emmanuel, and maybe for some present to come for the first time to faith in him. Amen. In response to what God has begun in the first advent of Christ, let us go to hymn 16 and stand together.